This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 50 years is a long time to stay in any career these days, but for Ed Williams, there were very few dull moments. As a journalist, he had a ringside seat for many of the most important news events affecting our region in the last half of the 20th century. As editor and editorial page editor of the Charlotte Observer for 25 of those years, his columns and commentaries served as food for thought, even in their day, even as he prodded and poked at newsmakers and took aim at the contemporary thoughts of the time. Some say he provided a moral voice to the community as it was buffeted by the winds of change. Well, now with some distance, those same columns provide a valuable window on history. And when you see them collected in one volume at one time, the impact is that much more evident. Ed Williams has compiled some of the choice pieces of the fruits of his 50 years of labor in his new book, Liberating Dixie, An Editor's Life from Ole Miss to Obama, and he joins us for the hour to look back and share some of his observations. Welcome back to the program.
Pleasure to be here, Mike.
And for purposes of full disclosure, we should mention that Ed Williams is now on the board of directors of WFAE, which had no impact on our decision to book him for the hour. We would have had you here anyway.
what the directors do basically is think about how to raise money. So I don't think there'd be much connection. It is a pleasure to be here again. If I weren't on your show, I'd be at home listening to it. I'm an addict.
Well, thank you. Congratulations are in order to you and to the Charlotte Observer, because yesterday it was announced that Kevin Sires, the editorial cartoonist for the last 26 years, won the Pulitzer Prize, and you hired him.
I did indeed hire him. After Doug Marlette left, we conducted a nationwide search for Doug's successor, and that means pouring through reams and reams of sort of pallid, unfocused cartoons by everyone out there with a pencil who wants a job. And then I got this packet from Minnesota and opened it, and my eyes popped. I mean, it was powerful drawing, well-focused cartoons, good understanding of the themes from this kid whose major experience had been drawing for the college daily newspaper. So Rich Offal, who was the editor at the time, and I went up to a cartoonist convention in Washington, which is where all the cartoonists go looking for jobs, and spent some time with Kevin, and we saw we had our man. And finally, the rest of the journalism world saw it, too, and he won the biggest prize yesterday.
And Doug Marlette was a hard act to follow.
Yeah,
he, too, had won a Pulitzer.
Yeah, he did. Every cartoonist, I guess, Gene Payne, Doug Marlette, Kevin, all our cartoonists have won Pulitzers.
How do you explain that?
Well, I think it's a good place to be a cartoonist. The first thing you have to have, if you're going to have a great cartoonist, is editors and a publisher who are willing to take the heat. Because cartoonists are the guys who hide in the bushes and throw snowballs at the rich folks a lot of times.
Well, that's interesting.
Which can irritate people.
The article in the paper this morning talking about Kevin Sires' accomplishment, winning the Pulitzer Prize, and listing some of the other Pulitzers, because the newspaper itself and other writers have won Pulitzers down through the years, which is extraordinary, I think, for a newspaper of this size in a town of this size. Because it goes back to times when Charlotte was not what it is today, that you were already winning Pulitzer Prizes. And it talked about how a lot of newspapers today don't have political cartoonists, either because, A, they can't afford them because of the economics of newspaper business today, or they don't want to take the heat.
Yeah.
Why not? I mean, they don't want to be – I'm paraphrasing what the article said, but they don't want to be that involved in their community. Well, if they're not, they're going to die, aren't they?
Well – yeah, I think. But why would anyone want to do that? I mean, why would you want to have a non-controversial newspaper? Newspapers ought to be digging into things that make some people angry, and they ought to be doing it on a kind of non-partisan basis. I mean, the old line about the business of newspapers is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, I think ought to apply today. Mm. And I think if you abandon that principle, then you lose the life of the newspaper and readers notice. I think a newspaper needs to stand for something, and I'm not talking about politically. I mean, stand for shining light on things that people would prefer that you didn't.
The paper won some Pulitzers when you were the editor or the editorial page editor. One had to do with one of the editorials that we're going to talk about later on today, and I'm trying to find it. Maybe you could help me out here with a brown lung disease, among other things, which is, an investigative report, series of reports in the paper, which is something that the Observer still does, despite the economics of the newspaper business. But put this into some perspective for non-newspaper people. How important, what does it mean to get a Pulitzer? What does it say about the paper? What does it do for the paper? What does it do for the person, the individual, in Kevin Sayer's case, for instance, to have won this award? Is it better than an Oscar? Is it better than an Emmy? What does it mean?
Well, very few newspapers win Oscars or Emmys, so it's the highest prize in the profession awarded by judges from the profession.
Okay.
The people who choose the winners in journalism are expert journalists themselves. So that recognition is always good. What it says about the Observer, I think, is that under the ownership of first the Knight brothers and now McClatchy, the Observer has maintained a strong commitment to investigative journalism. And that takes time.
And money. Because sometimes the stories never see the paper.
Sometimes they don't. Newspapers can say, it's just not there,
right,
and move on to something else. Whereas if you're in television, for instance, and you see send a crew out, chances are it's going to be on TV regardless of what they find, just because of the mechanics and economics of it. But we have some excellent investigative journalists, and we devote time and money to letting them do their work. The same with cartoonists. The reason cartoonists have been cut from most newspapers, or many newspapers, is not that newspapers can't afford cartoonists, it's that they choose not to have them. Well, the Observer's publisher, Ann Calkins, wants a cartoonist and is willing to take the pain that sometimes comes with having it, because she believes that's what part of the newspaper ought to be, something that uses visual editorialism essentially to make a point.
The newspaper gets heat about everything it prints. It gets heat about the fairness and objectivity of what appears on the news pages. It gets criticism about what appears on the editorial page and about the editorial page cartoon. So what's the difference between getting criticism for an editorial cartoon versus an editorial in the paper, or something that may not be completely accurate but appears biased to somebody?
Well, I can speak only to the editorial page because that's the role I had all my time here. But if people disagree with an editorial, they want to argue about it.
Mm-hmm.
If people disagree with the cartoon, they want to lynch the cartoonist. It's a much more visceral reaction to cartoons, obviously, because it's a visceral art form.
Because a picture's worth 1,000 words?
Well, I don't know whether a picture is worth 1,000 words or not, but a picture sure can sting more than 4 or 5 paragraphs can, unless they're exceptionally tart paragraphs.
And yet in that article, Jesse Helms, who took, I think, umbrage at a lot of political cartoons that appeared in the paper, used to have them up on his wall, and he'd use them to raise money.
Well, yeah. Jesse Helms had very thick skin, and Jesse Helms used to be an editorialist, you'll recall, on WRAL-TV in Raleigh. And he said once that the cartoons kind of remind him that he's not the be-all and end-all of existence, that there are people who disagree with him, and sometimes they make good points, and he said that he valued them for that reason.
Yeah.
And he would, as sure as you do a hostile cartoon about Helms, somebody from his office would call and want it. I'll tell you a story about a Doug Marlette cartoon. Bill Arthur was the Observer's Washington correspondent at one time, and Doug did his infamous cartoon that showed Jesse Helms dropping his trousers and mooning the Capitol. I want to point out that I was not editorial page editor at that time, and I wouldn't have run that. I don't like bathroom humor in cartoons, but it caused quite a stir, and Bill asked Doug if he could have the original, and Doug sent it to him. And in a little while, Bill got a call from Doug and said, I need to get that cartoon back. And Bill said, well, sure, why? And and Doug said, Henry Kissinger wants it. So they do make a point.
You know, the title of your book, the full title, is Liberating Dixie, An Editor's Life from Ole Miss to Obama. And it pretty much encapsulates your time in journalism. You saw a lot of change over your 50 years.
Well,
Do you think somebody starting out today in journalism will see something similar to that? Or did you live through extraordinary times?
Well, I did live through extraordinary times, but almost everybody does. It's just that journalists notice more, I think, because we write it all down. I was at the University of Mississippi when the school was integrated. Mm-hmm. This was at a time in the 1960s, which was also the celebration of the centennial of the Civil War. And the governor of Mississippi, Ross Barnett, had been going around the state to centennial rallies wearing a Confederate officer's uniform and telling people essentially that the Civil War was our ancestors' battle to preserve the Southern way of life. And the current conflict, which was over civil rights, basically, is the opportunity for your generation to defend the Southern way of life. So there was a kind of fervor in Mississippi about challenges to segregation that was more intense, I think, than even in other Southern states. So when James Meredith, after a long legal battle, was finally admitted to the University of Mississippi, the whole state was riled up, and people flocked to the campus to protest this. And as night fell, a riot broke out. The federal marshals had accompanied Meredith there to protect him. They were kind of holed up in the Lyceum, which was the main administration building, and mobs started attacking them with rocks and bottles and even some gunfire. And the marshals were essentially trapped in the Lyceum with this raging riot going on outside. And President Kennedy sent in federal troops to restore order. The campus was occupied and reeked of tear gas for the whole year, but two people were killed in that riot. And it was a time when a lot of young people, I mean, I was, I guess, 20 years old, a lot of young people had to make some very difficult choices about essentially which side they were on. It just seemed to me bizarre that you would think there was some moral cause in depriving 40% of your state's residents of the rights of citizenship. So I wound up on the side that supported integration and supported a significant challenge to the Southern way of life. My views became sufficiently well known that when I ran for editor of the student newspaper in a campus-wide election, I was defeated by the largest margin in the history of campus politics. People were clear on the issues there.
How do you explain your stance on that? Because you grew up where, in Memphis or Missouri?
I grew up just about 90 miles north of Memphis in that part of southeast Missouri that should have been Arkansas. You'll notice on the map there's just a little corner cut out of Arkansas because when Missouri became a state, a man who owned a lot of land down there wanted all his land in the state, so he got Congress. Imagine this, a rich and powerful man getting Congress to do something. He got them to just draw the line down to include all his land. So it was essentially Arkansas, flat land that had been flooded by the Mississippi for eons, demographically and geographically identical to the Mississippi Delta. But we had not been subject to the kind of racist leadership that ruled Mississippi since the Civil War. So I grew up without that feeling of public approval for maintenance of segregation.
You know, if we'd had this conversation last week, talking about what went on at Ole Miss during that time period would have seemed like ancient history. And, well, thank God we're over that and we've moved on. And yet, this week, we had that incident with the guy who killed those people. I forgot what state it's in, but he was a Ku Klux Klan member and a white supremacist, and he went after Jewish people and ended up killing all Christians.
Yeah.
So that set of thinking still is out there.
It obviously is.
What would you say as an editorialist about that?
I would say that kind of thinking is still out there, and it's a responsibility of each citizen to oppose it whenever he or she encounters it. You cannot let people think that that's okay, and you cannot sit around and listen to racist jokes or anti-Semitic jokes and think that's okay. It's not, and it creates the climate in which this sort of thing can happen.
Ed Williams is our guest. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7, WFAE and 90.3, WFHE. Our guest today, Ed Williams, former editorial page editor and editor at one time of the Charlotte Observer. He's the author of Liberating Dixie, An Editor's Life from Ole Miss to Obama, which is a collection of commentaries and editorials that he wrote in his time at the Observer. And it should be mentioned that Ed Williams is a member of the board of directors of WFAE, which played no role in... if we had known you were on the board, we wouldn't have invited you. No, I'm just kidding.
I was on before. before I was on the board, too, Mike.
Right.
The question is, should you reject me because I joined the board?
You were a young reporter, a cub reporter, so to speak, when you got in during the civil rights era.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote about this.
Sure.
Was it difficult, A, to write about it from a reporter's point of view in an area of the country? I think you were at Hodding Carter's newspaper in Greenville, Mississippi, which James Cobb called the most southern place on earth. Was it difficult to write about it? Were you allowed to write what was going on? Was it severely censored or edited or changed to reflect a certain point of view that was the subscriber base of the newspaper?
Mm-hmm. No, not in Greenville. Greenville was sort of an island of almost progressivism in a very politically, I would say, backward state.
So it was the city of Charlotte in the state of North Carolina?
Well, no, it was the city of Greenville. You understand that Greenville is essentially a port city. It's right on the Mississippi River. And it was the home of a lot of very wealthy planters who had made a lot of money off cotton during the days when cotton was king. And it had a kind of cosmopolitanism that you don't associate with a lot of Mississippi. William Alexander Percy, who's the novelist Walter Percy's adoptive father, lived there, and a lot of progressive folks. And Hodding Carter, the elder, Hodding Carter Jr., had won a Pulitzer Prize in the 1940s. For editorials on racial tolerance. And then his son, Hodding III, came back from after being at Princeton and in the Marines to edit the newspaper, and it continued to be a progressive voice in politics. Hodding later got more involved in politics and served as a spokesman for the State Department under President Jimmy Carter.
Right.
No relation. So Greenville was kind of the exception, a very aggressive, a very progressive newspaper that tried to cover what was going on in the state. So what I was doing was not merely tolerated or accepted, it was encouraged. It's what the Greenville paper did. Speaking of that time, I came back to Mississippi in 1967 after 2 years of the Army. That's after the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act. So blacks had been very active in politics and were beginning to seek political office. And one of the people who was running in our area was Fannie Lou Hamer, a great civil rights leader. She was a short woman, very compact. I describe her as looking like an oak stump. I mean, when she's saying, "We shall not be moved," you believed it, you know. So she was running for the state Senate. And a lot of people who liked her thought, well, but, you know, she's never had any political experience or anything. She's a good woman, but in the state Senate. So I asked her, I said, "Ms. Hamer, even a lot of people who like you and support you wonder if you're qualified to be in the state Senate." And the result of that was the greatest quote I ever got as a journalist. She said, I'd known her a long time. She said, "Now, Ed, the only way to learn how to be a senator is to be a senator. And if you have to be a senator to get to be a senator, then there wouldn't be any senators because ain't nobody born a senator." I thought, you're exactly right. People are not voting for you if they do because of your skill and experience. They're voting for you because you will represent them in a way that they're looking for.
Wow. You came to Charlotte. I think the Charlotte Observer is the second, outside of college, was the second newspaper you ever worked for, correct? And you said that the title of I read that the title of your book was inspired by W.J. Cash's assertion that this region has been paralyzed by its hostility to dissent, and that you had worked throughout your career to liberate the region from that hostility. Did you need to become an editorialist or an editorial page editor to do that work? Could you have done that as a reporter, or was that simply your ambition talking to you to move?
Well, it was my ambition, and it led me to the editorial page. But the fact is, that's what good newspapers do. I grew up reading a Memphis newspaper whose motto was, "Give light and the people will find their own way." And I think that's the calling of newspapers. Mm-hmm. What the editorial page adds to it is we look at the things we've reported and say, here's what we think about it. And if you're an editorial page editor, you know this for sure. You know that there are people out there who are just as smart as you are, just as well-informed as you are, just as good-hearted as you are, who are going to disagree with you about a good number of things simply because their list of priorities is different from yours or their idea about how to accomplish a similar goal is different from yours. So what the editorial page does is it engages in a conversation with readers. hoping they will respect your views and listen to them, but also requiring that you respect and listen to their views. And I think that conversation before the community is one of the most valuable contributions a newspaper can make.
You know, a reporter's job is to be accurate as that person can be when reporting the facts, and to keep their own opinions out of what they write. I know that's probably difficult to do, and a lot of people suspect that they don't keep their own opinions out. When you cross the line and you become a columnist or you become an editorial writer, your job is to put your opinion in to the writing that you do.
Yeah.
Is that a difficult transition to make?
Well, if it's difficult to make, you probably don't make it. You know, it's sort of Darwinian. You know, people go in the direction their interests and abilities lead them. For me, it was not difficult, because there are two ways to do opinion writing. One of them is with great passion, and I'm sure that's very satisfying to the people who do it. But I don't think passionate arguments tend to be all that persuasive. So my intent in college was not to be a journalist, but to be a historian. And I really like to put things in a kind of context that helps readers better understand the choices to be made, and then tell them why I'm making one choice rather than the other, and explaining it to them. It's Jonathan Swift, the great satirist, said it's impossible to reason a person out of an opinion he wasn't reasoned into. And I think that's certainly true. Most of us don't arrive at our opinions by reason. We arrive at them by sort of growing up in a culture where certain ideas are accepted. I think one of the opportunities and one of the duties, in fact, of the editorial page is to say, here's something we're doing and we have always done and smart people have approved of that just may be wrong, and we need to look at that. It certainly was the case with segregation. It certainly has been the case with discrimination against gays and lesbians. It certainly has been the case with discrimination against women. And I think somebody needs to point the spotlight at that and say, look at this. Is this the kind of society we want to have? And if not, here's some things we might do to change it. That, to me, was the opportunity of the editorial.
But I suppose some people would say, well, who made you God? What made your opinion better than my opinion? And how do you justify that in your own head? Because as you said, there are other reasonable people out there with opposite points of view. They just don't have the platform that you have as an editorialist.
Yeah, and I think one of the duties of the editorial page editor is to make sure those other people do have a platform. If you read the Observer's editorials, you get the opinion of the newspaper's editorial board. Letters to the editor, we always gave preference to letters that criticized us over letters that supported us. And you ought to be able to read the op-ed page without knowing what the Observer's editorial preferences are. There ought to be a good mixture, a good battle between ideas on that page. So I think our responsibility is to lay out the whole argument, but also to make it clear what side we agree with in that argument.
But why should we care?
Well, some people care and some people don't. You know, if you care about public life, if you care about public policy choices, if you care about politicians you elect, it's helpful, I think, to have someone whose opinions you know look at those people and say, here's what we think of them. I mean, the Observer, I invited Jesse Helms to come to an editorial board meeting when he was running for re-election in the United States Senate, and he politely declined, saying, I think your minds are made up about that. And he was right. You know, we would not have endorsed Jesse Helms. By the same token, I think it's helpful for me or anyone else to sit down with people we don't support and don't agree with and hear them make the case for their arguments, because that's how you learn. And I think the newspaper's opportunity is to give readers that opportunity too. That's what we try to do. Let me go back to one point.
Sure.
I want to explain to people the difference between the newspaper editor and the editorial page editor. The editorial page editor was me. I was in charge of the opinion on the editorial pages in the newspaper. I'm in the opinion business. That's what I do. The editor of the paper, the last one I worked for, was Rick Timms. He's in charge of the newsroom, the news gathering operation. I've often described it almost truthfully, by saying that the editorial page editor's job is to grapple with the great controversies and ideas of our time, and the editor's job is to preside over endless committee meetings. So the editorial page editor has nothing to do with news. The editor on the news side has nothing to do with opinion. Each of us has our own function and try to perform it according to the standards of that craft.
Right.
So it's you just ought not to get confused about that.
But because people aren't in the business, and because the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Charlotte Observer have been labeled liberal newspapers, primarily, I would think, on the basis of their editorial page, that then colors people's opinions of the news pages. And the editor of the news pages, as you pointed out, although he may not be putting his opinion in, maybe he is, because the editor decides what stories get covered. The editor decides what stories get printed. The editor decides how long those stories, how many column inches those stories will be. The editor decides where in the paper those stories will appear. So if it's on the front page above the fold, it's going to be seen. If it's on page 17 in a column that's 6 inches down and it's in the middle of three ads, it may not be seen.
I think that's absolutely true. Everything you do in a newspaper involves choices. I mean, you were talking about the reporter's job being to seek the truth. Well, the reporter's job is to seek as much truth as you can cram into 10 inches with a 10 p.m. deadline. I mean, it's I think, a steady march toward a better understanding of whatever we're talking about. But it's obviously a craft limited by some very practical considerations. But on the point of choices, I think that's exactly right, and people need to understand that. The choices depend on a kind of set of news values that is usually unstated but is quite often shared by the people who work for the newspaper. Choices about what stories are most important, and those are the ones to which reporters are assigned. Those are the ones to which space is given. And there's obviously a value judgment in there. And
we do the same thing in broadcasting.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to. I mean, to do anything is to choose not to do something else. And I think if you looked at newspapers in the 1940s and 50s, before race became one of the dominant issues in American political culture, you'd see that stories back then about racial discrimination or violence or something like that tended to get very little play in newspapers unless they somehow threatened white people. And then as society evolved and our understandings about what racism was doing to America developed, I think people saw that those were more important stories than they'd been given credit for. And you see the change in the way the newspapers cover them and display the stories that result.
And I would imagine a lot of this is changing very quickly, given the fact that the Observer is not just a newspaper anymore. No newspaper is just a newspaper. It's online and it's updated constantly.
Well, it is, and it's the major provider of news and information for this region. But it's a very competitive world out there, and a lot of information providers who seem to me to have no standards of accuracy at all are on the same the same pages that you see on your computer. And it's one of the real challenges of being a citizen looking for information these days is to figure out what you can trust.
Lieutenant Governor Jim Gardner once asked you for a copy of the Observer's editorial policy, and you wrote back to Lieutenant Governor. I don't know if what you wrote back is the actual policy in print, but I think you encapsulate it in some way. It's on page 4.
Oh.
I thought I'd have you...
Did I get to do a reading?
Yeah, I thought you'd get
nice.
To read that
yeah,
response.
This was a letter in 1991 from the Director of Communications for Lieutenant Governor Jim Gardner, and she said, essentially, the Observer's entitled to its opinion, but we'd kind of like to know what our editorial policy is. And I think she was meaning not only what we stood for, but our policy in regard to permitting responses. And I wrote back saying it's a reasonable request. And while we didn't have an editorial policy written down, I would just write one. I said this, we stand for truth, justice, and the American way. We like calling North Carolina home. We support the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule, and the philosophy expressed in Matthew 25, verses 31 to 46. We would like to be able to love our country and to love justice as well. We believe government is too important to be left to the politicians. We think those who believe absurdities are likely to commit atrocities. We believe talk's cheap, there's no free lunch, a stitch in time saves nine, the unexpected usually happens, the unexamined life is not worth living, and everybody is ignorant, only on different subjects. And I invited Lieutenant Governor Gardner to submit pieces to us expressing his opinions or in response to ours and thanked her for her question. And he did. Of course he did.
If you are against what somebody has said in an editorial and you ask to see the editorial policy and you are given that screed, I would think that makes you very angry because you can't argue with it.
You think, if I may use a technical term, we are a bunch of smartasses. Yeah. Well, but you know, we're all in the process of trying to figure out what's true and just and valid. And readers are part of that. And when they call us on something, I mean, Lieutenant Governor Gardner is part of the argument with the editorial board. And I think readers need to hear the whole argument, not just us. I mean, it's our intent has never been to win an argument by silencing the opposition. That just makes no sense to me. That's not what we should be about. We should be promoting the argument, promoting the discussion. If you read the correspondence between me and Jesse Helms, you'll see that he gigs editorial writers pretty well. And he should. I mean, we are people who have our opinions, but they're not necessarily the only opinions or even the best ones, though they're the best we can offer at the time.
And you called it a discussion, which I guess in many cases, as an editorialist, you start because you say something which then provokes that discussion. And as an editorial writer, you live in the community, and so people are only too willing to discuss it with you. How did you – because people get really upset. All you have to do is go to any website where somebody has posted an opinion and look at the responses to see how vitriolic some people can get about certain things. And I'm sure even before the internet, you were getting letters and postcards and conversations in person and probably some phone threats and things like that on your person because of what you wrote. Am I wrong?
Well, a friend of mine who was married for some time to an only child, of which I am one, said that there's something called only child's disease, and that is you believe that if people knew you, they would love you. And I think that was kind of my attitude. I believe that if people could just talk to me, they would calm down and we could have a reasonable discussion. And in most cases, that was true. People tend to be at their worst when they're writing for a kind of anonymous audience, an audience that isn't people but is kind of the atmosphere or something. Right. And when you actually get people to sit down and talk with each other, you can focus a little better and not have that kind of vitriol. But people get upset.
Yes, and you have to endure their incredibly mean-spirited criticism and withering criticism is a good way to say it. We'll come back and talk about that, and then we'll share some of these editorials. Ed Williams, our guest on WFAE. A member of the WFAE Board of Directors, who's wearing his Board of Directors suit and tie today, is with us on our program. Ed Williams, former editorial page editor for the Charlotte Observer. His new book is called Liberating Dixie, An Editor's Life from Ole Miss to Obama, a collection of his opinion pieces that have appeared in the paper over the last 25 to 50 years. Withering criticism. I have been the recipient of it. I know what it feels like to get it. You have to develop a really thick skin. But most people don't come up to me in a parking lot, although some have, and say things. They did that to you a lot, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, if you have your picture in the paper every Sunday with a column, people tend to notice you and think they know you. And some of them even like you. But the ones who are more likely to approach you are the ones who have a bone to pick with you. I've written the book about being a pallbearer at an old friend's funeral. And we carried the casket to the hearse, and I turned around and walked about two steps before somebody jumped on me about something the Observer either had or hadn't done. And I tend to hear people out, and the guy wasn't furious or anything. He just wanted to make a point.
Yeah.
And a friend came up and said, people do that to you all the time. Come up to you. You just put the casket down. Somebody jumps on you about your job. And I said, yeah, all the time. And he said, well, I wouldn't have a job like that. And I was thinking, I wouldn't have any other job. I mean, it shows that guy cared enough about what we were doing to want to engage me about it. And you talk about withering criticism. I do not wither under criticism. I mean, I'm a Baptist deacon who for 35 years was an opinion writer. If you wither, you'll be withered out before much time goes by.
Yeah, you a certain kind of personality.
Yeah, either, sure.
As you say somewhere in one of these articles or maybe an article about you in that business, you either get out of it or you last.
Yeah.
It seems to me that writing an opinion piece, it doesn't matter what the topic is on, but on a civic issue, on a presidential election, choosing a candidate, endorsing a candidate, that comes with a great and heavy responsibility. What if you're wrong?
Well, what if you're wrong? I mean, you publish again the next day.
But a lot of people vote. Some people vote for the candidate endorsed by a newspaper. Others vote against the candidate because the newspaper endorsed them. So that comes, you're actually affecting the country.
Well, I think we're affecting some voters. But the reason we're affecting them is they've come to believe, A, that we share their approach toward public issues. And you can tell that. I mean, we write about it every day. And B, that we're doing our best to give an accurate picture of circumstances as we see them. Even if you're doing that, sometimes you're going to be wrong. I remember right after I'd come here, we'd endorsed, the editorial page had endorsed a politician who said he would do some things and went to the state legislature and did exactly the opposite. And Reese Cleghorn, who was the editorial page editor, then wrote a very brief editorial, and the headline was, "We were wrong." And sometimes you're going to be wrong. I mean, people who voted for Patrick Cannon did not expect him to be in the predicament he's in.
I have forgotten. Did the paper endorse him?
No, did not. I wasn't there, but they did not. But sometimes you make your best judgment, and it turns out not to be right. But people understand that. I mean, we're human beings doing the best we can, and I think that's all people ask.
In this book, which, by the way, is very heavy. It's got good paper in it.
Thank you, Mike. high praise. It's good paper, Mike Collins. Boy, we use that endorsement.
Yeah, can I put it on the jacket?
It's going to be a bumper. That'll be a bumper sticker. That's great. Thanks.
You reprinted an editorial that you wrote in 2008 titled "We Recommend Obama." Why should people care who the newspaper chooses to be a president? And were you right? Looking back on that, was that an endorsement that should have been made?
Well, I wrote the endorsement in the North Carolina Democratic primary, and we chose Obama over his opponent, who was at that time Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. I think it was, obviously. I wrote it. it's an odd thing that we do. Most of the writing we do has to do with public policy choices on various issues, how to fund education, for instance, what teachers should be paid, all that kind of stuff. And you kind of have some facts and figures to back that up and overlaid on a set of values about the importance of it. If you're dealing with political candidates, however, it's a different game because it's very, each candidate is going to have some positives and some negatives, and it's really hard to predict, based on prior experience, what they'll do facing the challenges of the future. So what we try to do is analyze the candidates and say why we favor one over another, which is essentially what voters do if they're thinking about the race rather than just voting party line. Mm-hmm. Of course, party line determines how most voters vote, so they're not really looking for any way to change their mind. But it seems to me if a newspaper is going to be writing about public policy choices, the most important public policy choice we make is who's going to run the government. So I would find it odd if a paper that says it cares so much about good public policy didn't also care about who's elected to make and execute that policy. But people understand that we're coming from a certain set of values and principles, and because we write them every day. I mean, if there's ever a fully disclosed way of thinking, it's on the newspaper's editorial page because we lay it out there every day and people get to see it.
You wrote an editorial called "Only Whites Think Racism Is Dead." That was not in 1965. It was in 1989. Mm-hmm. What provoked that editorial?
I have to read the book, Mike, but I think it was when a group of kids went to a small club in South Carolina to swim, as I recall, and they were turned away because there were some black kids in the group. And to their credit, the other kids wouldn't swim. They just left. And clubs make all sorts of explanations about how we're not racist and policies and all that stuff. The fact is, that's racist. And I think it was a lesson to those kids and a lesson to society that black folks are not just making this up.
Right.
They feel the pains and the barriers and the restrictions in ways that white people will never understand. I mean, racism is a problem for blacks, but it's a problem of whites. I mean, we have to think about what we're doing and how we're treating people. And the whole arc of my book, from Ole Miss to Obama, has to do with race in very many ways, because that's the most phenomenal change that, that has occurred in this country during the 50 years that I was a journalist. The incredible breakthrough in civil rights for African Americans in this country. Now, we're not there yet. I talk about liberating Dixie. We haven't liberated Dixie. I mean, it's a continuing struggle to against all these things that have been holding us down and holding us back. But on race, the progress in this country, basically nonviolent process, progress caused by the courage of a lot of people, most of them black, has created a revolutionary change in this country. But one thing you can always say about America, I think, is not that it's perfect. God knows it's not, but that tomorrow it's likely to be better than it was yesterday. And to me, that's about the best thing you can say about a country.
In 1994, you wrote a column, the title of which contains the N-word.
Yes.
And you used that word liberally throughout that column. In that editorial, you say that no white man can use the N-word. You did. What kind of reaction did
you get?
Well,
I didn't say that. I can't. I said without understanding the power of it or something like that.
But no white person can say that word.
Well,
you can't write it either.
Well, I did.
But you did, yeah.
Well, let me just talk about words. I think saying the N-word is stupid. I mean, what? why would you do that? You say it because you want people. I say it?
No, you cannot. And the problem with that is the 5-second soundbite, because you will be excerpted as having said it, and therefore you are a racist.
Well, you know, people will just have to do that. If that's how they make their judgments, they'll have to. I remember the great story about a Washington bureaucrat who was in some meeting, and he and they were talking about funding something that he thought was too small, and he said, "Well, that's a really niggardly approach to it," which
completely
means
different word.
And not even related. And he was fired for a brief while before somebody looked up the word. I think we're giving that word a lot of power.
Yes.
And we're acting in a sort of infantile way by acting as though it doesn't exist.
But you said you would not have let Doug Marlette print the cartoon of Jesse Helms mooning the Capitol building.
That's right.
Why did they let you print that word many times in the paper, in that editorial?
Well, it wasn't a question of them letting me.
Doesn't the publisher have the final word?
I think because if you read that piece, you see that it makes a cogent and important argument about the use of that word.
Any pushback from that article?
Some people wondered, why did you do that? But I think, you know, if you're writing 600 words, 700 words, you'd like to be judged on the 600, 700 words and not on one word. And I think people did that. I'm perfectly willing to defend that column without, and I've never had any feedback from it suggesting that I'm a racist.
Okay.
There's just some people who think it's inappropriate to use that word in any context at all, unless you're a rap singer, apparently.
It seems to me that what you did and what others who have followed in your footsteps do, whether you're writing a column like Tommy Tomlinson did every day or every 3 times a week, mm-hmm. or Mark Washburn does now, or whether you're doing an editorial page every day, that has got to be a grind. I mean, I don't have that many opinions, seriously, or I haven't formulated cogent arguments for a lot of things that I would be called upon as an editorial writer to put in the paper every day. How do you do it?
Well, if making your house payment depended on your ability to do it, you'd either do it or find other work. I enjoyed it. And if you're in that line of work, your mind kind of forms ideas and arguments as you see and read about issues, but not many people are in that line of work, and most of them who are in it are not very good because they're not thinking very much; they're just prattling.
You were the head of the curve, obviously, on the racial issue in the South, because you started in the '60s in the newspaper business and saw the wrongs and tried to right them, and wrote about trying to right them in maybe the '70s. Was it the '60s or '70s?
Yeah, 60.
In 2003, you wrote an editorial about the Supreme Court decriminalizing gay sex. In the first sentence, you say that the court did what it should have done 17 years ago. 17 years from 2003 would have been 1986 if I did the math right. Did you feel that way in 1986? Had you even thought about it in 1986?
Yeah, because, you know, if you live a life of a journalist, you encounter a lot of people, and you see a lot of things that the ordinary person living a normal life in Charlotte doesn't see. And one of the things two things I'd seen. One is that a lot of my friends were gay, and the second thing is that they were being abused in really unseemly ways. A loving couple could be convicted of a crime for simply being a loving couple. And, if you have any sort of sense of justice at all, you can disagree or agree about homosexuality, but there's no reason to put people in jail for it or to beat them for it or whatever.
You have said, I'm hopscotching through the book now. Okay. You've said that North Carolina has long favored lessening regulations on business because we want to be friendly, a business-friendly state. And this has a long history, and we have a long habit of looking the other way. Well, we're finding out more and more about the state regulators looking the other way. And coal ash, you wrote about this extensively in the 1980s. Brown lung disease was a big issue then. Have we changed any? Is it the same problem?
Well, I think there is something in the North Carolina governmental mindset that says what's good for business is good for North Carolina, and that government ought to be a partner of business. And my feeling is government ought to be a responsible partner of business, and that is if you're running cotton textile mills and you're unconcerned about the levels of cotton dust that are contributing to bisonosis, brown lung, which leads to disability and death. I mean, if you're a partner who lets that go on, you're a bad partner. And you're certainly, as a government official, not serving the public's need. The same was true of the chicken processing plant fire in Hamlet, North Carolina. 25 people were killed in the fire because the fire escape doors were locked to prevent pilfering. That plant had never been inspected. Most of the worst plants in cotton dust levels in the air never been inspected. Not a single one had been closed. So if you find that the state government has been really cozy with a major industry, that's not news. That's history.
But people say the free market will take care of those problems. If a problem like that crops up, the free market will address it by itself, doesn't need help, doesn't need regulation. And then they turn around and accuse people who believe that, such as yourself, as being anti-capitalist.
Well,
how do you answer that?
If you believe that, you just believe nonsense. I mean, capitalism is an economic system. It is not a moral system. I mean, capitalism was quite happy with slavery. Made no difference. Capitalism has no feeling. But capitalism is the best system imagined for distributing goods and services. It is not, however, a moral system. And whatever morality there is in it is imposed on it.
But is the government a moral system?
Oh, well, the government is the only way that citizens have to speak with any authority about things like that. I mean, if you hate the government, give back your Social Security check. But I think that government certainly is imperfect. But for every bad government action, there are a bunch of bad private actions too. And I think the challenge for a democracy is to have a government that is effective but not oppressive. And you don't just do that and say, well, we've done it. You do it every day. Let me say something. My publicist is here, and if I don't mention that I'm going to be signing and reading at Park Road Books at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, I'm in big trouble. So now I'm off the hook. Come out and see me, and we'll talk some more about this.
Very quickly, in 15 seconds, Chris emails, how did you decide which letters to the editor print? And also, The Buzz is the original Twitter. So how did you decide that? Very quickly.
Well, you look at all of them, and you try to, in some ways, reflect the opinions that you're getting in letters to the editor. You want points of view to be represented. The Buzz was my invention along with some other people, and you either love it or hate it. Yeah. And politicians tend to hate it, which maybe is justification for it.
Ed Williams' new book is called Liberating Dixie, An Editor's Life from Ole Miss to Obama. It is a collection of his editorials and commentaries over a 50-year career. Thank you for the hour.
My pleasure. My pleasure.